This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the pianist Stephen Hough. He's been performing at the very highest level for decades now, with worldwide appearances at every major concert hall, 25 proms, a catalogue of over 50 recordings, and an almost laughable number of awards to his name. His considerable abilities then are clear for all to hear, but as he exits stage left, his accomplishments continue. He writes, paints and composes too, being proclaimed by The Economist one of the world's 20 living polymaths. You can imagine his childhood, can't you? Highly intellectual, highly strung musical parents, obsessively coaching their tiny son, and his teenage years devoted to an abstemious life dominated by endless practice. Nope, it wasn't like that at all. He spent a long time begging his parents to even buy him a piano. They eventually got a second-hand one for a fiver. Later, at New York's prestigious Juilliard School of Music, he'd while away his days hanging around the corridors smoking cigarettes. He says now, "When I'm playing these great works, it's almost like being a priest or a rabbi. You're dealing with areas of human life you can't put your finger on. I love that there are no words. When I'm on that stage, it doesn't matter. We can share something of what it means to be on this planet at this time." So welcome, Stephen Hough, to our imaginary island. In spite of those 50 recordings, when I read that you said that, it struck me that actually that, you know, the ephemeral moment of live performance might be really the very thing for you, the pinnacle of what you do. Would that be fair?
I think when it works in a concert hall and you feel that the audience is with you and you have this moment of sharing, it's a pretty incredible thing. But recordings are good too, because you want to grasp the ephemeral as well. And I think the combination of the two is what makes modern musical life so wonderful, actually.
As I mentioned, you have, of course, performed at all the great venues and halls around the world. Are there one or two that stand out where you always know that the audience, you're each going to give each other a very good night?
The Proms is pretty spectacular.
Right.
I think partly because it's so many people in the room, I think around 6,000 people. And when 6,000 people are quiet, it's quieter than being on your own in a silent room, because there's a kind of electricity to that quietness. It's not so much the applause. I think people think that that's what we want to get from an audience. No, it's that moment when we share a kind of breathlessness. It's almost like a hallucination, really, with the music as a sort of a drug, in a sense.
Tell me about the first piece we're going to hear this morning. What is it?
We're going to hear one of my favourite pianists, someone who sadly died before I could have heard him play, Alfred Cortot. He's a pianist who was on one of the first records we owned when I was a child, and he's someone who has remained very close to me. I find his way of playing opens so many doors. He was such an imaginative player. And with this, the Chopin Preludes I'm going to take with me, these tiny pieces, each one of them he makes into some sort of epic emotional drama. You just feel that everything is expanding in his vision.
Alfred Cortot playing part of Chopin's Prelude in A-flat. Tell me, Stephen, have you been performing professionally since 1983, I think?
Yes, that's it.
And You're 54 now. How differently do you approach what is the same job compared to when, say, you were a 30-year-old doing it? If you're playing a bit of Rachmaninoff or whatever it happens to be, what's the difference now?
Well, you do learn certain things in the experience of playing concerts, but I still find that I'm nervous backstage. But much more important, I'm excited still about playing this music, even pieces that I've played many, many times. And I often look over at the world of the actor, an actor who's in a show for 6 months, let's say, running 8 shows a week, and you go in the middle of the 4th month, and still there's fire when that actor walks out onto the stage. And to me, that's a great inspiration, because that's what we need to have. If we're going to go out onto the stage, it's not that we won't have an off night, but there has to be something of that energy every single time. We have to find new insights into it every performance.
There is that hard slog of travel that underpins somebody's life who works at your level. Are you good at dealing with that, at that sort of itinerant lifestyle of here we are on another plane, booking into another hotel room, sitting alone again at midnight? You know, how do you deal with that?
The loneliness doesn't worry me, and that's why the island is not such a concern for me, because I'm an only child. I spent a lot of time on my own, and since I've been professionally working, I spend most of my life alone, come to think of it. Even backstage, unlike a chamber music performance. I don't even have a pianist if I'm a violinist in the next room warming up. I'm there completely alone. I have friends all over the world, and that makes travelling wonderful. But I like the time also alone. I like those intervals between being either on stage with thousands of people in the audience or being with friends at a dinner party. I like that time.
Tell me about your next piece of music then. What are we going to hear? This is the second piece today.
This is the violin piece by Fritz Kreisler, Liebeslied, arranged by his friend Rachmaninoff, who's one of the greatest pianists of all, and of course now better known as a composer, although at the time he probably played more than he was seen as a composer. This track was on one of the very first records that my parents bought when I started learning to play the piano. We had no classical records in the house at all. My mother went into Dawson's in Warrington, a little music shop, mainly selling guitars, but they had a small section of classical records too, and bought this record called Keyboard Giants of the Past. And I think it's probably the most important thing that happened to me in my learning the piano, because it introduced me to some of the greatest players and a style of playing which I still love, and to this track of music, which is one of the great examples of how to play the piano.
That was Kreisler's Liebeslied, arranged and performed by Rachmaninoff. So, Stephen Huff, as you say, you were an only child. You were born in the early 60s. Your mother was Netta, your father, Colin. Tell me about them.
My father was in British Steel. He was a technical representative and travelled all over the north dealing with people's steel problems, but his heart was in the arts. And for a complicated set of circumstances, being born in Australia, his parents separating, spending time in India, he never got a chance to explore his artistic side until later in his life. In fact, right at the end, he died around the age I am now, so he was in his mid-50s. He did an Open University Humanity degree, and it was a great joy to him at the end of his life finally to do something that he would have preferred to have done when he was 18. Of course, there was the war as well, and many people's lives were not so easily directed at the areas that they would like to have explored. I often think of him now. He was born on the 11th of November, and every time the clock, I see in a digital clock, 11:11, I think of him and think of how he would have enjoyed being part of my life since.
And your mother?
My mother is still alive. She was the practical parent. She would service our cars until the days of computerisation in cars. I never forget the time when we were looking around a house once and the estate agent was showing us around the kitchen. Oh, very nice, the bathroom. Oh, very nice. Then we got to the garage and there was a pit in the garage. We have to live here because I can get under the car to fix things. But I just look back also and I'm very grateful for parents who were just there, who were never pressing me to do things, who were always supportive.
How did you find the piano?
We had an aunt who had a piano and we'd visit her. And during tea and biscuits, I would go over and try and play nursery rhymes on this piano. I memorised a lot of nursery rhymes, according to my parents, when I was a kid.
100, I read, is that right?
I think that's what, yeah. I was passionate about the piano. I said, can I have a piano? Can I have piano lessons? They bought me a little toy piano. That didn't work out. And eventually, this £5 German upright from an antique shop in a village close by. And in those early years, I wanted to do nothing else but play the piano. My mother would actually have to drag me off the piano stool, go and get some fresh air, go and play some games. But things went wrong, I suppose, really when I started at Cheetham School in Manchester, which I really want to emphasise is now a wonderful place. I've been there many times to visit and the atmosphere there is fantastic. It was not a wonderful place when I was there. It was chaotic educationally. But in some ways, although looking back now, the freedom that I had, I think enabled my imagination to grow in weird ways, which I'm grateful for now. I didn't have a sort of methodical education. I wasn't bound by endless exams and endless homework. I can't remember doing any homework looking back. I used to watch television all night.
So much more to talk about, Stephen Huff, but for now let's fit in the music. Tell me about your third. What are we going to hear?
Well, this is Led Zeppelin, Stairway to Heaven, because this piece symbolises that whole period of my aimless youth, when I would spend my time in the bedroom burning joss sticks in my flared trousers and my platform heels, doing absolutely nothing except listening to rock music. It also, I think, is a very beautiful song.
There's a lady who's sure all that glitters is gold, and she's buying the stairway to heaven. When she gets there, she knows if the stores are all closed, with a word she can get what she came for.
Led Zeppelin and Stairway to Heaven, as you described it, Stephen Huff, in your bedroom, joss sticks burning, flares on, platform shoes. Do you look back at that young boy and does he seem like a different person altogether?
Completely. It's actually quite chilling for me to hear that because it's such a different part of my life that I almost can't. I mean, I can remember it very clearly, but it feels like I've been reborn into a different person.
You said that as you hit adolescence, around about 12, you had what you characterise as a sort of mini nervous breakdown. What happened to you?
Well, I was afraid of being mugged for some reason. And then after sort of overcoming that fear, I was mugged. I mean, not seriously, but enough that I was punched in the stomach by a couple of guys wanting money. And then a man came up to me and said, would I like to come to his office? Because I was crying at the time. And so the combination of the physical violence of being mugged and then this rather sinister man offering to take me to his office, which was a complete coincidence, it just made me feel very uncomfortable. And I had to see the doctor quite a bit and I didn't want to leave the house. I didn't want to go to school. I had almost a year off school, actually, around that time.
And just to be clear, in the years that had preceded that, you had been doing extremely well as a young, talented pianist. Indeed, at the age of 8, I think, you'd been in a piano competition and the judges had remarked that, you know, you were an outstanding pupil, and there had been a headline in the Daily Mail with a photograph of you saying, could this be the next Mozart? Well, I mean, that's the tabloid press for you, but
right.
What do you remember of that time between the sort of ages of, say, 8 and 12 prior to the attack and the sort of sense of being sort of agoraphobic?
Well, those were the times of spending my whole life at the piano, I suppose.
Yeah. And when your parents find themselves with this little boy that they loved so much who didn't want to come out of his room, what did they do to try to help you? through that?
I was never told off. I'm amazed, really. I think if I had children, I'd be saying, you can't watch 6 hours of television a day. You know, why aren't you reading something? Or, but they didn't.
Was it real trash TV?
Oh, gosh, yes. I can still remember some of the plots and the characters.
And this, ladies and gentlemen, is how you get a concert pianist for a child. You let him watch as much trash TV as he wants. Tell me about your next piece of music.
This piece of music is one of the most important pivot points of my life because my composition teacher at Cheetham School suggested I got to know it by playing the chords that are part of this section that we're going to hear and saying, what's this, my boy? And I didn't know. And he said, it's the dream of Gerontius. He said, go and get the records and study it. And I loved it instantly. It was my first introduction to Catholicism, which later became an important part of my life. And it was my first reintroduction to serious music, having had this period when I was listening to Led Zeppelin and Burning Joss Sticks. So here was me listening to Roman Catholic music by a Catholic composer. And it was around the time I was, I suppose, 14 or so, and it really planted a seed.
That was part of the Go Forth Chorus from Elgar's The Dream of Gerontius, performed there by the combined Halle Choir and Sheffield Philharmonic Chorus and Ambrosian Singers with the Halle Orchestra, conducted by Sir John Barbarolli. You said, Stephen Huff, as we went into that, that this was a pivotal moment in your life, a pivotal piece of music, and the main reason for that was it connected you to Catholicism. Are you saying that if you hadn't heard that piece of music, you then would not have gone on to become Catholic?
Very possibly, yeah, because it sort of opened that particular door at a time when I suppose I was quite vulnerable in other ways. And it brought a whole new seriousness to my life.
Am I right in thinking that you seriously considered the priesthood at one point?
At two points, actually. The first point, very immaturely, I just loved the whole Catholic thing. And I thought the Franciscans would be the best because they wore these wonderful brown robes and I could have a rosary hanging from my knotted cord around my waist. And it wasn't quite as flippant as that, but there was an element of the theatrical about it. And I wrote to the Franciscans around the time I'd got a scholarship to go and study at the Juilliard School. And I said, you know, I'm going to give up this scholarship and I want to come. And the novice master said, well, I think you should go to the Juilliard for 2 years, actually, and then come and see us when you come back. It was a very wise bit of advice. I think he could see that I was immature about this decision. But then later, it reemerged in a more serious way, probably about 5 or 6 years after that moment.
And what happened on that occasion?
I started to take my practice of Catholicism much more seriously, and I really felt that perhaps I had a vocation to become a priest.
And later on, you wrote about the complexities of living life as a gay man and also being a committed Catholic. I'm wondering, as a young man, being gay and being Catholic in the 70s and 80s, how personal did the Church's rejection, revulsion even, at that possibility strike you, given how close you were to your Catholicism?
Well, I realised at one point if I wanted to become a priest, or indeed to be a serious Catholic, at least as I understood it at that time, that meant a lifelong of celibacy as a gay man. And I rebelled against that very much for a couple of years. And then I came to a point when I thought, well, I'm going to give this a go. Maybe it can work. And it did. I lived, not as a priest, of course, but as a serious practicing Catholic, not thinking it was possible to have any kind of emotional connection with another person in that particular sort of way for about 15 years. I lived this solitary life, I suppose, very much as a sort of travelling monk. I was always considering whether I would give up the piano and become a priest. And I was told constantly by bishops and priests and monks, no, your altar is the piano. I remember one priest describing his priesthood as being a bringer of joy. And I thought that was a wonderful phrase, because in a sense, I think that's what I as a musician would love to feel that I can do, is when I play concerts, actually to bring joy. I'm not hectoring, I'm not preaching. I just play this music, and sometimes that music touches hearts in a way that I have no power over. The person receiving it doesn't really know what's happening, but something is healed, something is brought comfort to. And if that happens at any time in my life, I'll think that my life has been worth living.
Let's have some more music, Stephen Huff. We're going to listen now to your fifth.
This is the B minor mass of Bach. Bach, the greatest composer, probably, but someone that I've always had a bit of a blind spot for. So I want to take this to the desert island because I'm sure that if I sit down with Bach there, we can become friends.
Part of the Kyrie Eleison from Bach's B minor mass, performed there by the Monteverdi Choir and the English Baroque soloists, conducted by John Elliott Gardner. Stephen Huff, you were accepted to the Royal Northern College of Music. You were just 16 years old, really very young indeed. I think their youngest ever acceptance of a pupil. And while you were there, you won the piano section of the BBC Young Musician of the Year competition. I think that was in its inaugural year. And then you ended your degree by winning this very significant scholarship that allowed you to go and study, well, anywhere in the world, I think, under the terms of the scholarship.
Yes.
And you chose, as we know, Manhattan's Juilliard School. Did it seem like a long way from Warrington?
Yes, it did. But it was a wonderful experience. And I remain passionately devoted to New York. So I've lived there the longest I've lived anywhere in the world. I've been living there since 1981. I came out of my shell at that time. I really grew up.
Were there any sort of sleazy New York dive clubs, disco nights, partying till 5 a.m.? Was there any of that?
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely.
I'm so glad.
Yes, the discos, of course, were very in then. And
yes.
I did go to quite a few discos over the years. And I can still remember the horror of waking up, of course, very late, but with the din, my ears still actually ringing from the music that I'd heard 8 hours earlier. And that was scary. I thought, this can't be good for these eardrums.
You won a highly prestigious international piano competition whilst you were a student at Juilliard. And that launched you, really did it, on your international concert career. That was the pad.
Totally the beginning. I was 21 and suddenly I really had to grow up instantly because I had to get a manager. I was playing with the Chicago Symphony in a few months. So what repertoire do you want? Then I had to get a social security number and pay taxes. And every concert when you start a career as a debut, everything is like an audition. And it was stressful. People look now to winning competitions and they think that that's the achievement. But in a sense, it's really just the beginning of that road. And it's how you use those years after the win to have a sense of humour, too, I think, is also important. It's rather funny that we should be nervous standing in the wings of a concert hall and we're going to walk out and people are going to clap these two pieces of flesh together that make this weird noise we call applause. And I sit down in front of this instrument that was invented, you know, 150 years ago and play this concert. It's all a bit ludicrous, really, if
so
you think about it.
You sort of embrace your inner perfectionist and neurotic to kind of get you there and then see the absurd nature of it all. Is that the
tension? The balance. It's the balance between everything matters and nothing matters. And to me, if one can get that right, then that's kind of the most wisdom one can get out of human life.
I'll take that. I'm going to put that in my pocket and take it away for the date. For now, though, let's hear some more music, Stephen Huff. We're on your six. Tell me about this.
This is the Berg Lyric Suite for String Quartet. It's chosen for a number of reasons. One, because this is the recording by the Juilliard String Quartet. And Robert Mann, who was the first violinist of the quartet for 50 years, was a very important person in my life. He was chairman of the Naumburg competition, which is the competition that I won. And he was very supportive to me in the years that followed. We played a lot of chamber music together. And this piece, this movement, this crazy third movement of the Lyric Suite, I think I would find endlessly fascinating on the island to listen to.
That was part of the third movement from Berg's Lyric Suite, played there by the Juilliard String Quartet. Stephen Huff, an important part of your musical life more recently has been composition. You've written more than 30 published pieces. What is the sensation, having played so much great music from our greatest composers, what's the difference in sensation of performing a piece of your own music?
Well, it's just so much more personal in that way. There's a kind of energy and excitement from within that I don't think, although I'm certainly very excited and energetic playing other people's music and playing music of the greatest composers. But I think when you're writing your own music, it's just, well, maybe it's like your child. You know, you can say, well, my child isn't Mozart, but you have a sort of connection to that child, however lacking in gifts or intelligence, that's fantastic and close and is the most important thing in your life. And I think that's a similar thing. These pieces are my children.
One of your most probably well-known pieces nearly didn't get completed.
This was a mass that was commissioned by Westminster Cathedral, and I'd been sketching it over... I usually take about a year to sketch, and I keep things in my briefcase. And I had 3 days at my mother's home and very little else to do. And so I took out my sketches and I put them together, put them in my briefcase, played a concert with the Halle Orchestra in Manchester. It was a Sunday evening, got in my car and drove back to London and had this car crash. And I overturned on the motorway at 80 miles an hour. I was spinning round in the car and landed in the hard shoulder. And I was conscious as the car was turning that I had these sketches with me and I would never get to hear this piece that I'd spent so many hours in the previous 3 days working on. And then I was alive, and so the piece did eventually get performed and then was later orchestrated.
That's a profoundly affecting experience that you went through during the composition of a piece. Did it affect the piece that you wrote?
I think it did. I'd composed three of the movements. The Agnus Dei, I sketched actually waiting for a brain scan. I was sitting there and I had a couple of hours to wait. And I think it's a much more anguished movement than it might have been otherwise.
Literally on that note, tell me about this then, your seventh piece of music.
Well, this is one of my own compositions. I thought it would be nice on the island to have some reminder of this part of my life. But also because it was written for my friend Stephen Isserles, the cellist. He commissioned this from me for a friend of his to play who'd lost the use of his right hand. So it's a sonata for cello and left hand. Thank you.
Stephen Huff and Stephen Isserles performing Les Adieux from My Castaway, Stephen Huff's sonata for cello and left hand. It struck me as I listened to that, aside from how beautiful it was, that when I spoke to your friend and their fellow player, Stephen Isserles, about listening back to recordings, he said to me, well, I absolutely don't. I can't bear the thought of it. It'd be like a dog going back to inspect his mess, I think, indeed, he said to me, which really profoundly did shock me. But as you were listening to that there, what was occurring to you about that piece of music, about your composition and your playing of it?
Being on this desert island alone, listening to that, it reminds me of all the wonderful friendships that one has in the musical world. I mean, there are some bitchy people around, but musicians on the whole are tremendously supportive. It's a wonderful community of friends and people who are involved in these emotional experiences on stage together. So having this on the island, I could say that, no, I don't want any of my recordings, but actually I think I would like to remind myself, especially if I lived a long time, which I hope to do on this island, of former life and of former friends and ways that we've made music together.
When you think back to your 12-year-old self, it is an extraordinary life that you have fashioned for yourself. As you say, you spend a lot of time in New York. You have an apartment there, although I know also you live in London. You live this international career. You're under scrutiny, you know, by the finest eyes in critical musical thinking and so on and so on. It's a big life. When you think of that little boy who didn't want to come out of his room, who was worried about the world, who didn't want to be mugged at the bus stop, does he seem like another person altogether?
In some ways, but also I often think the wings of the Sydney Opera House, you know, how far this is from Thelwall, where I grew up. And maybe someday I should go back and open a sweet shop in some little village somewhere. There is part of me that's uncomfortable with a certain kind of international life. I often sort of feel that I want to retreat back into my bedroom with the purple walls and the Led Zeppelin Stairway to Heaven. Of course, not really, but I'm very happy with my life. I'm very lucky not to get depressed. And I say lucky, really, because that's something that some people live with in a very terrible way. And I'm really deeply grateful that I'm basically an optimistic sort of person.
We've learned then, with regard to sending you away to the island, that you will be fine with your own company. But I'm wondering, I don't know if your hands are insured. Are your hands insured?
No.
Have they done much DIY?
Little bit.
Would you be capable of building the shelter? Would you go to fish? Would you?
I'd certainly try, yes. I'm not sure about building. I'm not very good with very heavy stuff.
Let's have your final piece of music.
Well, this remains in the area of friendships. This is Eric Coates, of course, well known as the composer, in fact, probably best known as the composer of the theme music of this very programme. And this is Robert White, very dear friend of mine, and it's Eric Coates' Bird Songs at Eventide. I have a real sentimental streak, and I love music from this sort of Edwardian period. It's a sort of combination of all of those things in my life that that are important to me.
Bird Songs at Eventide, composed by Eric Coates, with lyrics by Rodney Richard Bennett, performed there by Robert White and accompanied by my castaway, Stephen Huff. And you did mention to me, I hope you don't mind me saying so, Stephen, that during that it's rather become your party piece with Robert White. If you find yourself at the right dinner party with the right piano, you can sometimes finish the evening with a rendition of that.
We nearly always do. And I've now played this piece from memory, and he does too. And he's singing it at the age of 80, as beautifully as he was on that recording, which is, I think, from about 20 years ago.
It's time now, then, for me to give you the books. I'm going to give you three books. So there's the complete works of Shakespeare and the Bible, and you get to take another book of your own.
Well, I've chosen to take Proust, Recherche du temps perdu, in a dual language version. I don't know whether one exists, but we'll find one, I'm sure.
I'm sure we'll find
you
one.
You have influence here.
Oh,
so
we do.
For two reasons. One is that I've dipped into it over the years but never read the whole thing. And I would love to study some French while I'm on this island. And I think there's no better way, really, than doing it, than being able to sort of go between English and French and learn my French this way. I might have a rather sophisticated vocabulary when I finish, but I think that would absorb me for many happy hours.
And I've been told that your Bible has to be a specific version. I've got a note here. Tell me more about that.
Yes, I want to have the Tyndale translation, which is the earliest version in English, or the by one person, at least 100 years before the King James Bible. It's also, it would be having some of the most beautiful poetry with me, as well as being something that would be inspiring.
That's yours then. A luxury too. What will yours be?
I want one of the hat maker in Chicago, Optimo's $20,000 straw hats.
$20,000 straw hat?
Yes.
What accounts for the price tag, I wonder?
Handmade with the finest threads you can imagine. It takes almost a year to make each hat. But I think being on the island, it would be very useful. And I'm presuming this is a warm island. It would be very useful as a protection against the sun. And it's a rather splendid item to have.
It will be my greatest pleasure to give you that then as your luxury. And finally, perhaps most difficult for musicians who are cast away, which one of the eight would be your one to save from the waves?
I think I'd probably take the Elgar, Dream of Gerontius, just because of its place in my life as a very important changing point.
Stephen Huff, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.